Okay, so I'm on the bus, right? And it's a bus that goes to the Old City and goes to Mea Shearim. And it was like a wintry day, you know, one of those days in Yerushalayim that's cold, but it's not like, you know, not too cold, but it's cold, winter day. And I get on the bus, and I always would try to sit next to a Furmayid. Because I'm personally not makbid, you know, not to have a woman sit next to me or sit next to a woman. I don't look to it, like, you know, if I can sit next to a guy. But on the bus, I don't, you know, I mean, Rav Moshe's famous tshuva, basavay, benogea, benagia, basavay, subabosas, right? Notwithstanding. So I always try to sit next to somebody, because I think, like, you know, that way you just save them from being uncomfortable with somebody. But this bus was, like, crowded, right? But it's only because I have that minhag that I noticed, you know, sort of who's on the bus and whatever. Anyway, so you know how it is. Like, you're on a bus, some people get on, some people get off, things move around. Anyway, this girl gets on the bus, okay? And she's, you know, dressed in somewhat less than appropriate attire from the perspective of some of the people on the bus, right? Shalom Aleichem. And she sits in the back of the bus next to this fellow who looks like he lives in Mea Shearim. You know, I hate the stereotypes, but for the purpose of this discussion, okay? He clearly is struggling with this, you know, but he's in the back of the bus, right? And he actually has, I don't know if you know this, there's a seat on the bus that means that you're the king of the bus. And you may not know this, okay? If you sit in the back of the bus next to the window, okay, that back seat in the middle, you're the king of the bus. And you may not know this, but this is the fact. That's the best seat on the bus, okay? You're in the back, you're up high, you're next to the window. For whatever the reason, this guy does not want to move, okay? But this woman is sat down next to him, and he's annoyed. And I understand why he's annoyed, because there were actually a couple of other seats on the bus, right? And she dafka sits in the back next to this guy. Like, have a little sensitivity. He's a firm yiddy. He obviously doesn't want you to sit next to him. He was there first, but all right. So he gets annoyed. You could see he's getting annoyed. He's like going like this. He's like looking at her. And so, you know, she's giving it back to him. They're having this glaring thing. So he opens up the window. Right? Now he's, you know, fafrumt with a coat and whatever. But she's somewhat less appropriately attired for winter. So the wind is coming in. So now she's getting annoyed. So she says, Slicha, shasigot achalon, can you close the window? Right? So he says to her, if you had more clothes on, you wouldn't be cold. So she looks at him. Now, you know how Israelis are. Now everybody's getting ready for a good fight, right? So she says to him, well, if you went to the army and did a little service, you wouldn't be so snotty, right? Why don't you close the window? So he says to her, why don't you make your sleeves longer? And they get into this dialogue, and then unfortunately I had to get off the bus, okay? And I was thinking about this. Like, that's a very interesting question, right? At what point do you have a right, maybe even a responsibility, to get into someone else's face? Right? Where is our responsibility? And I want you to understand that this is becoming a question that is growing in the Jewish world. You know, I mean, recently this year in the news, in Beit Shemesh, Ramat Beit Shemesh, there was a woman who was on the bus, and she sat down in the front, and she didn't realize it was a woman in the back, you know, from the bus, or whatever the details were, I don't remember. And a guy gets on, a firm guy, and he asks her to go to the back of the bus. And she, you know, the new firm Rosa Parks, says no, and it got violent. I mean, you know, I don't know exactly how it happened there, and I'm sure there's two sides to the story. But basically, apparently, at least, you know, according to the newspapers, which is just the most horrible thing, to her credit, by the way, she would not give interviews afterwards. And she was a firm woman, whatever that means. And they threw her to the ground. I mean, mamash, they threw her to the ground, and somebody hit her. It was a terrible story. And stories about Ramat Beit Shemesh and throwing rocks at buses because they're going through religious neighborhoods and all this sorts of stuff, right? It's an interesting question. I mean, imagine, I think it was Jonathan Rosenblum wrote an article on this not so long ago in the Jerusalem Post. Imagine that that a neighborhood becomes 70% religious, you know? Whatever that word means. And there's a pool. So when the first firm people moved in, you know, so they just didn't go to the pool because it was mixed swimming. Then when they were 30% in the neighborhood, so they said we'd like to have separate hours. You know, and I'm sure they went through their battle and maybe they got separate hours. Now they're 80% of the community. Do they have a responsibility? Do they have a responsibility to close down? Then they have the ability to do it. To stop there being mixed swimming in the pool. Right? On the one hand, you know, there's a halachic issue with mixed swimming. It's not a halachic issue, it's an isser, right? You know, right? On the other hand, there is 20% of the population there that wants mixed swimming. What's your responsibility there? By the way, there's very, very little halachic literature on these topics, because it's a new issue, right? For a lot of different reasons. You know, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, you had a frum neighbor, you didn't have a frum neighbor, it was an issue. And this is, you know, buses going through the neighborhood on Shabbos, this is becoming more and more of an issue, right? So where is the responsibility to compromise within the context of our relationship with community and with each other, you know? You know, we get this kind of question in Israel all the time. You know, I had to come up with all sorts of creative ways to achieve certain halachic parameters that I wanted to achieve. Like, for example, students come in, I don't know, you run a birthright trip, and they're coming to you in the Old City. And these kids, you know, it's a mila that they're in Israel. Okay? I've had students on our birthright trips that had never been in a room with other Jews before. Do you understand that? There was a girl, in fact, I used to make fun of these types of names, and I stopped, because there was a girl on our trip from Moose Jaw, Nebraska. There is a place called Moose Jaw, Nebraska, and this is the Jew who lives there. And she ends up in Israelite. And we were talking about halfway through, what do you feel has made the most impact on you? And she said, being in a room with 40 other Jews, that is amazing. 2 days later, she went to a mega event where they had 3,000 screaming college-age students, Jews, from all over the world. This girl went bananas. She went bananas, right? So on the one hand, they have nothing. On the other hand, so now they, you know, a guy meets girl. They start to like each other because it's a co-ed trip, right? You can't run. Well, at least then you couldn't, right? So they start holding hands, you know. One of them wants to sit in another one's lap. How do you... I don't want to get into halachas nigah. So we used to talk about sensitivity, be sensitive. There are different people, madrichim, teachers, and that always worked. What is your responsibility to get into someone else's face? Okay? And that's a general rule of chinuch. At what point, right? And you know, there are all sorts of tshuvas on this. It's interesting to see that we're living in such a different generation. Right, like for example, there's a tshuva of a chazanish in Yerodeh, I think in Chelek Beis, that talks about the fact that there may be no. He says that there's no din, right, of moridin vein malin, because the majority of Jews today are not religious, and therefore there'd be no point to it, right? There's no. It doesn't apply, he says, in a state of hester upon him. In fact, I heard from someone who I trust greatly that the chazanish told a rav that he should let people who are mechalel Shabbos have aliyot on Shabbos, because since the majority are mechalel Shabbos, the whole idea of not giving someone aliyah to encourage him to do tshuva doesn't make sense anymore. The Chazon Ish. So the realities are changing, but how do you find the balance? Okay, and do we need to bother trying to find the balance? Right. So that's one question. And I think that in terms of the general question of compromise, right? So there's a Gemara. The Gemara is, I actually photosetted this page, but I don't really think you need it, but if anybody wants the page while I'm learning it, you'll tell me, right? But it's a straightforward Gemara that most of us know. It's a Gemara in Sanhedrin and the Vav and Rebbe is the famous Sugya and Pshara and Betza, right? Well, it's famous because I know it, but anyway. Pardon? It's Daf Vav Amud Beis. If anybody wants, you could, you know, we're not going to go through and take apart this Gemara. I originally thought we would, but based on time constraints, I don't think we will. But if anybody wants, you can take a look at it. So the Gemara says like this. There are two shitas in the Gemara here, okay? The Gemara says, Rabbi Lezer Benoshel Rabbi Yossi Aglili. This is the second line in the Gemara on Vav Amud Beis in Sanhedrin. Rabbi Lezer Benoshel Rabbi Yossi Aglili. Omer, asur liftzah. You can't make a compromise. Right? We're talking about Bezdin here, right? V'chol abotzeh, harei zeh, right? Chote. That's a pretty severe language. If two guys come before you, and one guy says, he owes me $100, and the other guy says, he doesn't owe me $100, and you want to say, listen, why don't you just, you know, settle on 50? Just give him 50. So, you can't do that. Right? So the Mefarshim here and the Rishonim talk about, you know, why that is. Is it because the Beis Din can't be a party to Sheker because it has to be Sheker? So I'm not going to get into the sugya, but okay, right? V'chol ha-mevarech et ha-butzeah, harei zeh minayetz. This is unbelievable. If you value compromise, now you can imagine this is a difficult Gemara for me, right? If you value compromise, if you bless compromise, you're a blasphemer. Okay? Now, by the way, just so that we're on the same page here, what does it mean, mivarech? Like Rabbi Aaron mentioned this before, but he didn't explain it. So we've talked about this before, but just so again, we're all on the same page. The word bracha can mean many different things. If you ask, if you ever want to do an interesting experiment, and you're sitting with a group of balabatim or a group of students, whatever, and you say, what do you make a bracha? What are you doing? They will almost always come up with an answer. And what is that answer? They say, what are you saying? You take a piece of bread, you make a bracha, what are you saying?
Thank you.
You're saying thank you, right? But of course you're not saying thank you, because the word for thank you is a different word. It's todah. And we have many tefillot that are thank you. Nodelecha, modim anachnu lach, right? Bracha is a different word. So Rav Soloveitchik suggests that the word levarech is to increase. Hashem berachet Avram bakol. Hashem increased Avram's wealth, his progeny, whatever it is. Right? And therefore, when I make a bracha, right, I take a cup of Coca-Cola, Diet Coke, right, which is inherently kadosh, right, and I make a bracha on it, and I transform the experience of just drinking Coke into experience where I share an experience with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I bring Hashem into the equation. Okay? So a bracha is increasing the presence of Hashem in my life in an experience. That's what it means when you give a bracha to your children. You're increasing the presence of Hashem in your relationship with your children. And by the way, if you dwell on that a little bit, when you give a bracha to your children, either now or one day, it changes the entire experience. Okay? Right? So what does it mean, hamivarechet abotzeah? So hamivarechet abotzeah is someone who increases the compromise. It's not just that he's saying good on you. He's increasing the presence of compromise in the world. Now, I think that's me. So that's pretty scary. I raise him in nights. If you bless compromise, you're blaspheming Kosh Baruch Hu, you're cursing Kosh Baruch Hu. Right? Din. Now what is din? So din basically, like everybody knows the Gemara, you know, that well, it's actually a medrash. It's one of those things that everybody knows exists, but nobody knows exactly where it is. So Rashi talks about it, whatever, right? So Elohim is din, and Hashem is rachamim, whatever, right? So if we look at the beginning of Bereshit, right? So the first paragraph is Bereshit by Elohim, remember Elohim Yehor, right? Everything is Elohim. Then you look at the second bracha, right? Vayishev Vayinicheo Hashem Elohim, right? Right? So Vayitzer Hashem Elohim et Adam. All of a sudden you introduce Hashem. So the Chazal asks, well, what's Hashem and what's Elohim? So okay, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world through Din. And then he saw that the world couldn't handle Din. So he introduced Rachamim. And everybody knows this idea. It's a very difficult idea. First of all, what is din and what is rachamim? And second of all, what does that mean? Hashem created the world to din and then saw it wouldn't work. Like, what was there? Was there a celestial oops? Like, what does that mean? How can HaKadosh Baruch Hu see something that doesn't work? So one way of understanding that is that the world should be a world of din, and the world needed to experience din before rachamim was introduced. So what is din and what is rachamim? This is, by the way, a seminar for a day. We're putting this into nine, you know, the minute and a half, but so that we can do this Gemara. Let's assume for the moment that Elohim means you get what you deserve. That's what din is. You come before a bezdin. If you owe $100 to somebody, din is that you pay the $100. Because that's what should be, because that's what you deserve. Right? If your son broke the mirror, he has to pay for it. That's din. Rachamim then, right, is where you get what you don't deserve and you haven't earned. From the word rechem, when a baby is born, it hasn't done anything, hasn't earned anything. All the love that you give a baby is pure rachamim, it's pure chesed, it's pure giving, because they haven't earned anything yet. Right? So the world really should work through din. We want to earn what we get. In fact, there's this Kabbalistic idea, which Chassidus is full of, this Vasemis discusses this, that when we move beyond this sort of three-dimensional existence into whatever is beyond this, you know, sort of beyond the curtain of Mavet, right? In the world of Sheol, whatever that means, right? Sheolah. So the consequence of the mistakes that we've made, of the chataim that we've done, right, is going to be this intense embarrassment, right? Lachma de kisufa, it's called. We're going to realize all the things that Hashem gave us that we didn't earn, and we're going to be embarrassed. You know, it's like if you walk into a hall and everybody stands up and starts clapping. You don't know what they're clapping, and they usher you up on the dais and they sit you down and they, you know, they start announcing and they see you. You have a name tag on it. It says Benny, and their honoree is Benny Friedman, and they're honoring you for helping, I don't know, cancer victims. You've never helped a cancer victim in your life. You don't know what they're talking about. You don't know where you are. So you're embarrassed. But then you see a whole bunch of your friends in the audience. So now it's uncomfortable. So you get embarrassed. Why do you get embarrassed? Because they're giving something you didn't earn. Right? Every time you feel embarrassment, you should know it's a glimmer of that lachma de kisufa. Somebody, you give a great shiur. You know it's a great shiur because you could see that people are getting something out of it, and then someone comes over to you afterwards and says, that was amazing, and you're embarrassed. You know why you're embarrassed? Because it has nothing to do with you. Right? If good Torah comes from a person, it's because the people that are listening have merited to receive that Torah. And Hashem has blessed you that you become a vehicle for the Torah. It has nothing to do with you. You don't get a thank you. It's ridiculous. Right? Kadosh Baruch Hu, just, you know, you have to figure out why. You have to thank Kadosh Baruch Hu, but, right? You're embarrassed because you know you didn't earn it. It's not real. Right? Okay, so Elohim then is Din, and Hashem is Rachamim. And the world should be a world of Din. We want to be in a... And by the way, this is also a paradigm for relationships. Right? Relationships in an ideal world should be Din. You know, you get married, you give, she gives. You don't give in order to get. But if one side is doing all the giving, the relationship is skewered and it doesn't work. Things go off. That's true in every relationship. It's true in our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is an interesting challenge. That's what we strive. That's the Avodat Hashem that we do. It's true in our relationship with our students. The best relationships you will have with students are the students that you feel are giving back. It could be the way they're giving back is that they're paying attention, but they're giving something back. They're giving their time, their energy, right? So, right? Yikov Adin Etahar. There should be a world of din. Compromise undermines the fabric of the way the world is supposed to be. Shenemar ki mishpat Elohim hu. And that's why the word there is Elohim. V'chein Moshe haya omer, Yikov Adin Etahar. אבל אהרון אוהב שלום ורודף שלום ומשים שלום בין אדם לחברו שנאמר תורת אמת הייתה בפיו ועולה לא נמצא בשפתיו בשלום ובמישור הלך איתי ורבי משיב מאבון. Aaron chose a different path. Now this is an interesting question. Moshe says Yikov Adin Etahar. Aaron is the Ohev Shalom, Rodev Shalom. Some of us just studied at one point, I think maybe last year or whenever it was, of Soloveitchik's Ma'amar, which is actually written up in English in Rav Bezdin's Reflections of the Rav, and the difference between the Rav and the Rebbe, Moshe being the Rav, Aaron being the Rebbe. It's an amazing discussion, and well worth a little bit of elaboration. And if you've never read it, I would urge you to read it, and if you email me, I'll tell you where you can find it, whatever. Right? Moshe does not speak to the masses. Moshe is the Rav. Aaron speaks to the masses. So you could say, and by the way, just for the record, I think that there are many people who have a Rav. I think there are very few people today who have a Rebbe. We need Aaron. We need the Rebbe. Much more than we need the Rav today. It's, and we need both. But we have more of the Rav than we have the Rebbe. If your chicken is treif, you can find a Rav who can paskin for you. But if God forbids your friend, a person's friend, commits suicide, and you need someone to talk to, it's much rather to find a Rebbe. Okay? And they train you to be a Rav. 3-4 years of smicha, they train you to be a Rav. You know, you may not know all the halachos, but you should walk away from smicha with knowing how to find the questions. But how to deal with the other? That's a lifetime. That's a challenge. Rabbi Lezer Omer, okay, we'll skip this part. Now look down. Rabbi Meir Omer, Lo Nemar Botzea, אלא כנגד יהודה שנאמר ויום היהודה הלכב מה בצע כי נהרוג את אחינו וכל המבורך את יהודה הרי זה מנעץ ועל זה נאמר ובוצע בערך נעץ השם. Now this is a very interesting question. Yehuda, according to the Gemara, affects a compromise. Now that's interesting because we think that Yehuda was the one who said מה בצע כי נהרוג את אחינו, right? What are we going to profit from killing him? Let's sell him. But that's what the Gemara says. The Gemara says Yehuda is making some form of a compromise. So what's the compromise of Yehuda? So, the brothers think that Yosef is worthy of death. They want to kill him. So you can go deep into the Medrash and Chazal. You know, he was a Rodef and all this stuff. But that seems to be what they think. Reuven thinks that we should save him and bring him home. So there's a debate going on. I'm not talking about literally, but theologically. So Yehuda says, listen, we're not going to take him home because the brothers all think that we should kill him. Maybe he has a din of rodef. We're not going to kill him because what if Reuven's right? Let's make a compromise. We'll sell him as a slave. So I would think that's a good thing. Unless compromise undermines the fabric of creation. And that seems to be the day I hear. Okay. But now comes Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha says, no. Mitzvah liftzoa. There's a mitzvah to do compromise. שנאמר אמת ומשפט שלום שפטו בשעריכם ולא במקום שיש משפט אין שלום ובמקום שיש שלום אין משפט. Right? The pasuk says you have to have משפט אין שלום. How can you have משפט אין שלום? They seem to be the opposite, right? משפט is din, שלום is not din, okay. אלא איזו משפט שיש בו שלום ואומר זה ביצוע. If you can get the parties to agree, then you don't need din. You can't enforce compromise, but there's a mitzvah to try to get the parties to compromise. Now, there's an interesting question whether this is necessarily machlokas. Whether Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha is cholek on Rabbi Yossi HaGlili, or he's addending to Rabbi Yossi HaGlili. Most of the Rishonim say that he's cholek, and interestingly enough, we paskin like Rabbi Yeshua ben Karcha. The Rambam paskin, the Shulchan Aruch, okay. V'chein b'David. Because what does David say? Who omer? V'hi David osem mishpat utztaka. Right? He does both. Say hello. Kol makom sheish mishpat in tztaka, v'tztaka in mishpat, ela ezu mishpat sheish bo tztaka, v'omer ze bitzua. David HaMelech made a bitzua. How did he do that? Atan l'tanakama. So how does that work out according to Tanakama? Dan et ha-din. Right? So first he would do din. Because it can't be the David HaMelech. Right? Because the first day says you're not allowed to do bitzua. So how does that work according to the first day? That you're not allowed to do a compromise? So no. You could do a compromise if it's after the fact. So how did David do this? First he did din. Zikah et ha-zakai v'chiyev et ha-chayav. Right? If you were chayev the money, and if you were innocent, so you were innocent. You were chayev. V'ra'ash nitchayev ani, so then he would see that a poor person was chayev. V'shilem lo mitoch beito. So then he would pay the poor person's money. Zeh mishpat utztaka, mishpat lezeh utztaka, and that's bitzua. So this is, hang on one second. So this is very interesting. This is very interesting. First of all, let's assume for the moment then that there seems to be an obligation to do bitzua. Okay? According to the Rosh HaPsak, if you have a machlokas like this, the second day is the one that we paskin like, and that's probably why the Rambam paskins that way. But what's interesting about this, to me, is Yehuda. Because Yehuda, the Medrash says, and Yehuda, it's in Breshit Rabbe, that, that Yehuda, in fact, not only did he do a bitsua that he wasn't supposed to do, but because he did a bitsua that he wasn't supposed to do, right? It's chayev benafsho. And that's why, according to the Medrash, his wife and children, that whole story of Aaron and Aaron, his children die. Now it's interesting. What essentially happens in the story of Yosef is gnevat nefeshot. Right? They kidnap Yosef and they sell him as a slave. Within the context of halacha, so such a person is chayev misa. And the way Chazal look at the stories of Breshit, okay, they're always trying to read in the predecessors of halachic parameters. So when the Midrash says that Yehuda was actually Nitchayev, and that Yehuda's children died because of the chait of Yosef, what the Midrash is saying allegorically is that Yehuda was Chayev for the kidnapping. That's very interesting. Because although everybody suffers to some degree from the story of Yosef, nobody else is punished in that way except for Yehuda. I mean, the brothers wanted to kill him. And they don't suffer. Reuven wants to save him, but he blows it. But the brothers want to kill him. So why is Yehuda the one who pays the bill? Especially since it seems that Yehuda is affecting a compromise. So if Yehuda is affecting a compromise, that should be praiseworthy. Why is Yehuda's compromise so negative? So Ravigdor Nevensal in his Sichot LeSefer Breshit presents a fascinating way to look at this, which makes a lot of sense. Not that he needs my approbation, but what's the problem with Yehuda's compromise? A compromise is okay. You know, it's kind of like, imagine I buy a car, and I get home, okay? Or you know what? You buy a car. Remind me your name? Daniel buys a car, and he buys it from Matan. Okay, so Daniel buys a car from Matan. He gets home. There's no engine and there's no radiator. So he comes back to Matan. He says, "You sold me a car without a gear clutch. Let's assume a gear clutch and an engine are both worth the same amount of money. It's close." So he comes back to me. He says, "Listen, you sold me a car, but I went to pick it up. There's no engine and there's no gear clutch. That's nothing." So he says, "Well, you never told me you want an engine and a gear clutch, right?" So Daniel looks at him like he's whacked. So they end up in front of a Beis Din. So the judge says, "Listen, you know, there's so much machlokas in the world. You say you don't owe him anything. You say he owes you an engine. Take the car with a clutch without the engine." So that's not din. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous, right? You buy a cow and you get a cow with two legs. And he says, "You know, we only own..." So you say, "Okay, take a three-legged cow." That's ridiculous. Right? Why is that ridiculous? Because the judge is affecting a compromise on the cheshbon of the litigants. What did David HaMelech do? David HaMelech's compromise isn't on the cheshbon of the litigants, it's on the cheshbon of the dayan. And one way of understanding this Gemara is that bitsua is okay if it's on your cheshbon, not if it's on theirs. Now I want you to understand that this is a tremendous asaga in chinuch. This is a tremendously important idea. Because one of the things that we have to struggle with is not just when to compromise, but who's willing to pay for the compromise. On so many different occasions, if you're affecting a compromise on the cheshbon of your students, something's wrong. There is, by the way, another type of compromise. There's a type of compromise where it's not yours to compromise. Like there's a famous story with Rav Kook and Rav Zonnenfeld, Yitzchak Chaim Zonnenfeld. In 1929, during the riots, right? I mean, they were massacring Jews in Hebron. So the British wanted to try to calm things down. And there was also riots going on in the Old City around the Kotel. So the British suggested to the Jews, they sent a message to Rav Yosef Chaim and to Rav Kook, because Rav Kook was the Rav of the Tzionim, and Rav Yosef Chaim was the Rav of the Haredis. So they sent a message to both of them saying, would you be willing to renege on your claim to the Western Wall for a period of time until the riots calm down? Because we'll be able to announce, the Jews have said that they don't, you know, the Western Wall is not ours, and we won't pray at the Western Wall for a period of time just to calm everything down. Now, mind you, there's no state of Israel, and there's no, the British could close down anyway, which they did on occasion. So Rav Kook formulated his answer, but he didn't want to write his answer to the British until he got in touch with Yosef Chaim to see if it was okay with him. And Rav Yosef Chaim didn't want to send his answer to the British until he got in touch with Rav Kook, because that they shouldn't send two different answers. So Rav Kook sends a shaliach to Rav Yosef Chaim. At the same time, Rav Yosef Chaim sends a shaliach to Rav Kook. And as luck would have it, the two shluchim meet. And when they compare their letters, they find that both Rabbanim have written exactly the same thing. Das Torah. What did they write? We would love to be able to compromise, but the Kotel isn't ours. It belongs to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Which is, by the way, a Musar Haskel for what's going on today, but that's a whole other discussion. So one of the questions you have to ask yourself when you get into the stage of compromise, can you compromise, will you compromise, is on whose cheshbon are you willing to compromise? Okay? If it's on your cheshbon, that's a legitimate question. I can't tell you how many times I've missed minyan because of teaching and students and whatever it might be. You know, I can't tell you, you know, when you first, you know, sort of step out of yeshiva, you're determined that you're going to learn 3-4 hours a day. But then you get into the world of reality, right? You know, I have a very hard time hanging on to a chavrusa. I have one chavrusa besides my children and whatever, because it's very hard for me to keep set times, right? You know, you have a chavrusa, you can learn Rambam. But then you get a call from somebody in San Francisco who says, you know, I'm dating this girl and I'm thinking about getting engaged. No, I'm sorry, we'll do intermarriage next week, I have to learn Rambam. So you never get to do your chavrusa. Right? Who says you have a right to set a chavrusa and then just not learn? That's a serious thing. So you have to ask yourself, am I compromising on my cheshbon or on the cheshbon of something else? Is it mine to compromise? That's one question. But then there's a second question. And this second question, in my opinion, is the essence of what Jewish education is all about. There's another piece of the story of Yehuda. Okay? Yehuda finishes this story and hits the nadir of his life. Vayered Yehuda mi'et echav, according to the Medrash, horidu mi'et adluto, because they said you should have convinced us and whatever else it is. When does Yehuda, the Nebuch, Yehuda, the intermarrier, right? When he intermarries. When does he become Yehuda the Melech? Right? Vayigash. So what happens in Vayigash? So Yehuda comes to Yosef. And Yosef has basically declared that Yehuda's going to be, that Binyamin's going to be a slave. Nachon? So what does Yosef, what does Yehuda do? Yehuda says, pardon? Ki avdecha arav et hanar. I took responsibility for the boy, right? And because I took responsibility for the boy, take me instead. So the Mefarshim asks some very interesting questions here. You know, Rav Ephraim Ashri has an amazing tshuva. Okay? Says, you know who Rav Ephraim Ashri was, right? Yes? No? Maybe? Rav Ephraim Ashri, this is, by the way, this is a must-read. This is a unbelievably inspirational thing to learn. Rav Ephraim Ashri was one of the last Rabbanim of the Kovno Ghetto. And when he was in the Kovno ghetto, so the Nazis, they wanted to, like, you know, shtuch a rabbiner, right? So they put him in charge of guarding a warehouse. They got him this ridiculous Keystone Cop outfit with a funny hat. And he had to stand in front of the, you know, like the Brady Bunch. Halt, who goes there, right? Okay. So he got curious. Who are all these high-ranking Nazi officials that are walking in and out of this warehouse all the time, right? So he takes a peek, and he discovers that what he's guarding is one of the repositories for the treasure of the Jewish people that will one day be displayed in some shape or form in the museum of the extinct Jewish race that was meant to be set up in Berlin after the war. I don't know if you know about this. It's an amazing exhibit in Yad Vashem on this. Okay? All right. So what did the Nazis put in this warehouse? Sort of, you know, the treasures of the Jewish people that were going to be extinct. They didn't leave all their paintings and menorahs there, because that went, you know where that went, right? We're still trying to find all that stuff. Sfarim. And the Nazis were meticulously organized. So what they had basically done is given the Talmud Chacham a library in the middle of the ghetto. So word got out that Rav Chaim Ashri had access to a library, and people started bringing in their shalos. And he was obviously a Talmud Chacham. So, you know, he didn't have the ability to sit. It wasn't like a base medrash, I'll get back to you in 2 days, you know. But he managed to sneak in or whatever, and he gave them answers. And he wrote down on little ptakim, on little notepapers that he could find, what the answers were and what the questions were. And he hid them in tin cans and he buried them. He survived the war. After he was liberated, he came back to Kovno and he dug up these cans. And he published them after the war in a set of shutim, five-volume set of shutim called Mimama came from the depths. Pardon? They have an annotated version, which is a one-volume set. I think it's called the Holocaust in Halacha. It's a very, very short version of some of the tshuvos. The tshuvos are amazing. I mean, they're lumdish because they were written after the war. But the stories at every tshuva, he tells you the story of that tshuva, of how the question came to him. So a guy comes to him, right, with a question of... are you allowed, right, are you allowed to step out of a death march if someone has fallen by the way? Now, if you leave this person who's fallen by the way, they're going to be killed. On the other hand, if you step out of the death march, you're putting your life in danger. Are you allowed to risk your life to save another? You don't even know for sure you're going to save another. And he goes through a very complicated tshuva, and he comes to the conclusion that you're not chayav to do it, but you're allowed to. It's an amazing tshuva. Who says Yehuda is allowed to risk his life? Yehuda risks his life. I mean, to be a slave in ancient Egypt is not a pashta thing. And many Mepharshim talk about this. How could Yehuda risk his life? So how do you understand how Yehuda risks his life? It's very simple. Because what is Yehuda referring to when he says, Ki avdecha arevet hanar? Right? When the famine is really bad, and they know they have to go to Mitzrayim, but Binyamin, if they don't bring Binyamin, they can't go down, because Yosef has said they can't go without bringing Binyamin. So Reuben comes to Yaakov, right? He says, take my children. If I don't bring back, you know, Binyamin, you can kill my children. So putting aside what a crazy thing that is to say, right? Like, can you imagine telling your father, you know what, if I don't bring the car back, kill my son. Like, that's a ridiculous thing to say. But okay. So Yaakov doesn't buy that for different reasons. So Yehuda waits a little longer, the famine gets a little longer, which is a whole discussion educationally as well. And then finally he says, Anochi arvenu miyadit tevakshenu, right? I will be arevet hanar. And Yaakov agrees. What was it that Yehuda said that convinced Yaakov to send Binyamin? What is arevus? You know, in Israel, if you want to buy a house and you don't have the money, right, so you take out a mortgage, right? So when you take out a mortgage in Israel, you have to get arevim. You have to get 3 to 5 guys, depending on the circumstances, and they have to sign on your loan. And it's a very uncomfortable thing, you know, especially when you make aliyah and olim, and they're trying to find solutions to this. Imagine you make aliyah, you're there 6 months, you don't really know that many people. Now you want to buy a house, so you want to get $100,000 loan. You got to find 5 people who'll sign on your loan, but you don't know people that well, right? What does it mean that someone signs arevut on a loan for you? It doesn't mean that you go to the bank and say, listen, if he can't pay his loan, I'll pay his loan. That's not what it means. It means his loan is my loan. If you can't find him, it's my loan. You can come to me. Arevut means you are me and I am you. That's the word. We're all mixed up. Right? You're buvia. What Yehuda is basically saying, and you see this, by the way, in different places in the Gemara. Right? There's a whole discussion in the Gemara about whether or not it's machlokas, whether or not you can split a city between Shvatim. Can you split a city between Shvatim? So the Gemara should bring a proof text from the fact that which city was split between which two Shvatim. Yerushalayim was split by Yehuda. The Gemara doesn't bring that proof text. Why doesn't the Gemara give that proof text? Because Yehuda and Binyamin become one shevet because of Arevus. It's one way of understanding it, right? Arevut means not you are you and I am me. You are me and I am you. Now, by the way, this is the yesod of compromise. The yesod of my willingness to compromise for you is because you and I are one. And I want you to know that this is the most essential piece of chinuch. If you cannot become a rev with the people that you teach, if we don't feel a sense of oneness, then our teaching will be missing something. That's just pshat. And I want you to understand how this works. You know, if imagine the physical experience, right? Imagine the physical experience. We're made up of two different things. We're made up of a guf and a neshama. That's not really a good term, made up. It's not really true, but okay, right? There's the illusion and the reality. Okay. So right now, if you want to know the difference between me and Matan, I'm here and Matan's there. So if somebody wants to know who Matan is, they point over there. And if they want to know who Bini is, they point over here. But this isn't really who we are, right? This is just a guf. Like, who is it that I really am? I am my neshama, whatever that means. Right? And my neshama is not physical. Now, just like HaKadosh Baruch Hu isn't physical, and therefore the Rambam says HaKadosh Baruch Hu can't be physical because something that's physical is here and it's not there, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is everywhere, your neshama is not physical. So now let's say Chas V'Shalom, yesterday HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided that me and Matan were done with the physical world, what they call death. Okay, so we're done. But there's no reason to assume our neshamot are done, because the neshama doesn't die, it continues in whatever way it continues. How would you be able to tell the difference between his neshama and my neshama? Right? The answer is you wouldn't be able to, because they're one. See, the guf creates the illusion that you're you and I'm me, but really we're one. And Torah is one of the vehicles that allows us to tap into the fact that we're really one. And that's, by the way, Malchus. The essence of Malchus is to recognize that we are essentially one. That's what the Melech is supposed to do. Right? I found the Rambam. Where was that Rambam? The Rambam. Yeah, there's two Rambams. The Rambam in Melachim in Perek Gimel Halacha Vav says by the Melech, Libo hu lev kol kahal Yisrael. Yehuda's Malchus, Yehuda b'gmas Melech. That's the essence of Malchut. Right? That's why we have three ktarim, because we have that sense of oneness. And the Rambam in Hilchas Tshuva, who talks about the Seir Mishpalech, points out, based on the Gemara in Yoma, that the Seir Mishpalech, the Kohen Gadol, was able to be mechaper for certain averot kalot, even if the Jew had no idea that the Kohen was offering the carbon. If a Kohen offers the carbon of the Seir Mishpalech, right? Okay? And the Seir Lazazel and the Seir Lashem, and does the complete avodah in Yom Kippur, all of Am Yisrael is forgiven for the averot kalot, whether they know it or not. That means that a guy can be eating a cheeseburger on Yom Kippur as long as he finishes it before Yom Kippur is over, and he's mechaper. It's unbelievable. Why? How could that be? Because that's the essence of kahuna as well. That's aro. Ohev shalom v'rodev shalom. Your chait is his chait. So his kapara is your kapara. That has an impact on all of us somehow. Which leaves us with the last point, which is that's what we need to figure out how to do. You want to know what you need to work on? What we need to work on as teachers? It's not whether we get more Rambam, it's not whether we understand every detail in Mishnah, but that's important. And I don't want to, Chas V'Shalom, imply that that isn't. It's very important. It's not the most important thing. The most important thing is that a student comes to sit with you and they have a question, and you understand they're not looking for an answer, they want you to hear their pain. And then when you're hearing their pain, you feel their pain. And you become so with your student that there's nothing else in the room. You know? You meet people. You ever have a meeting with someone and there's just two of you sitting there, but there's like eight of you? There's you and him and his BlackBerry and his cell phone and his laptop and his mother. Right? Just, you know? He's not really with you. When a student comes to ask you a question, when someone's asking you a question, you have to be so focused. It has to become such a habit that there's no one else. That student feels that right now they are the most important thing in the world. There are very few things that are more important in chinuch than this arevus, you know? And I think that this ability to take responsibility, to feel that much a part of the tziburim, of the different communities that we're trying to reach, is the difference between good and great in the world of chinuch. So that's a little bit of food for thought. I don't know if anybody has any questions. Yeah.
In terms of when to get in someone's face, when to...
Thank you. Because if you really feel that arevut with a person, you're not getting in their face. Because their face is your face. You're struggling to figure out where they're at.
So you're saying go resonate with the person when he's in front of you?
Absolutely.
If you really empathize.
Listen, you know what? There's an amazing Tzidkas HaTzadik. The Tzidkas HaTzadik says, and this is pshat. Do I have this here? 1 second. I think I might have this here. Hang on. It's worth reading. Do I still have it here? Yes, I do. Listen to the Tzidkas HaTzadik. Tzidkas HaTzadik says like this. K'sheba lomar l'chaveron. Lama osekach. When you want to come, right? You know who the Tzidkas HaTzadik was? It's the Tzadik HaKohen of Lublin, right? Pardon? This is from the Sefer Orza Rul HaTzadik, but you can find this very easily because if you get the Mada'i version of the Tzidkas HaTzadik, literally in the introduction, in the inside cover, they print what's called the Shlosh Esrei Midos V'Adrachos. It's 13 sort of, and they're all worth studying. I mean, we could go through them. They're just amazing adrachas. So he says, "Kishibalo malacha." This is what he believes are the 13 most important things, right? By the way, in terms of v'kol yisrael ha'arevim zeh l'zeh, and I believe as a mechanich. So one of them, number 7, is "Kishibalo malacha v'ro lamo sekach." When you come to tell your friend, right? The Rambam says in Hilchos Deos, "Haroeh et chaviro chotel atzmo." That is such a beautiful line. It's like if you want to give tochacha before you even start, you have to believe that this person is chotel atzmo. He's not chotel to you. He's not being machal your Shabbos. He's not machal Shabbos to the community. He's doing something to himself. It pains you to watch him harm himself. You know, you walk down the street and some guy's stabbing himself in the arm. It pains you that he's hurting himself. In other words, it comes from the fact that you care about him so much. Not that you care about yourself so much. If you want to give tochacha to somebody, and it's because you care about yourself or your community, it's not about him, it's not going to work. It may not work if you do it right, but at least he has to feel that you so care about him that he can hear it. Lo yomar lo miyad. You're not supposed to tell him right away. Eli yisovevo bedvarim mikodem. You have to turn him around with words. What does that mean? You have to show him, you have to develop a relationship with him. I don't think we're on the madrega, most of us, where in 3 minutes we can do this. This is weeks, months. You know, you can't go over to a guy who's eating treif out and say to him, you're eating treif out, it's not going to go anywhere. He has to so respect you and so want your opinion that you feel you're ready to say that to him. Right? V'tzarich lidayich lochiach. V'shelo yitzarich lochiach v'lachzor lochiach. You have to be convinced, according to Tzidkas HaTzadik, in my opinion, that if you say this once, you're done. If you don't think that that's, you may be wrong, but if you don't think that's true, then something's wrong. She'davar zim migune ve'ino tov. It's not good to be repeating tochacha. You have to give tochacha in such a way that he won't be embarrassed and stop connecting with you. Because it's not worth it. Amazing. Now, how you deal with this in terms of the Mishnah Berurah, does anybody know where the Mishnah Berurah talks about tochacha? It's interesting, right? Mishnah Berurah Aruch Chaim. There's one place the Mishnah Berurah talks about this. It's worth studying. It's in the halachos of Yom Kippur. Okay? There's a siman that talks about Lola Kalim v'sayerek, Mutav Shiyu Shogigin. There's a Mishnah Berurah there. There's a Ber Halacha, very difficult Mishnah Berurah. Worth studying and a lot of questions. So, basically, you have to become one with the person. Well, by the way, what does tochacha mean? The word tochacha lochich means to prove, right? What is it you're trying to... In fact, when you give tochacha, it's called reproving. What are you reproving? You're proving how much you care about someone. That's what you're proving. You know? If someone never gives tochacha, it must mean that he doesn't care enough. If you walk down the street and some guy's... And you see, I don't know, your friend's kid shooting up on drugs, you just keep walking. There's something wrong with you. How could you not care about that? Right? But that doesn't mean that the answer is to go scream at him.
So the barometer isn't necessarily what the person is feeling or how you feel it, but it's what your relationship with the person.
That is the barometer. I'm not, by the way, talking here about the halachic questions here are very complicated, but I'm talking about hashkafically, absolutely.
Okay.
And by the way, You know, it's usually a problem when you wait until somebody's doing something wrong to try to develop a relationship. The ideal, obviously, is that, you know, you're developing a relationship with someone not because they're doing something wrong. And, you know, you hope that most people have in their life someone that they're close enough to who can give them tocha. I mean, there's certain people, you know, I don't know, I mean, I've had that experience, I'm sure everybody here has, of someone you respect greatly who has to give you tocha. It's not easy, it's hard to hear, but it's tremendously valuable. And you can hear it because of it. In fact, it's interesting because you discover from that experience how close you are to this person. Because if you can hear tochacha from someone and the relationship continues to grow, then you're very close. It's no big deal to get shevach from somebody.
The reason I was looking at is that I'm really wrong with the really bad guys. In Hilchos Avodah, I don't remember the exact weapon, so I was looking for Rambam, which I can find, believe it or not, that's funny, Shaul. In Hilchos Avodah, there's a Rambam that talks about the mitzvah of escorting guests in your home. It's not just hosting guests in your home, but escorting guests as they leave your home. And the Rambam asked the question, what is the shir? Is there a shir of Shaul Yetzirah? He proceeds to explain that a rav l'talmid, a rabbi has a chiyuv to escort his talmid. Now, first of all, that in itself, in many ways, is a chiddush. We tend in our circles, we tend to think what? That the talmidim surround the rebbe and they follow the rebbe out. But the Rambam is pasuk halacha that a rebbe has an obligation to escort his talmid. That's number one, chiddush number one. Number two, he asks what the shir is in terms of how long that leviyah has to go on for. He says these words, Ad Ibar Shalim, the boundaries of the city. Okay, it's not just a howdy duty, thanks for coming, come here, hear a word of Torah from me, and then we'll send you on your way because that's what we do. You come to my house, I'm hosting you because it's a chidav. There's a the Rambam teaches, I think, an unbelievable halacha that a rabbi has an obligation to genuinely demonstrate that he wants to be a part of the life of his talmidim. And it's not just by symbolically inviting them in once in a while to hear a little bit of Torah, it's by wanting to spend time with them, wanting to spend as much time with them as possible. I mean, that's what the Rambam is teaching right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. So we're going to jam a little now.
Marif.
Okay.